This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents Memory Man. Written by David Baldacci. Read by Ron McLarty and Orla Cassidy. To Tom and Patty Maciag, go forth and have fun. You've earned it. Chapter 1. Amos Decker would forever remember all three of their violent deaths in the most paralyzing shade of blue. It would cut into him at unpredictable moments like a gutting knife made of colored light. He would never be free from it. The stakeout had been long and ultimately unproductive. Driving home, he had been looking forward to catching a few hours of sleep before hitting the streets once more. He pulled into the driveway of the modest two-story vinyl cider that was 25 years old and would take at least that long to pay off. The rain had slicked the pavement, and as his size 14 boots made contact, he slipped a bit before traction was gained. He closed the car door quietly, certain that all inside would be asleep at this late hour. He trudged to the screen door, leading into the kitchen, and let himself in. The quiet was to be expected, but the too quiet nature of the setting was not. He had not sensed that then, and later wondered why not. It was one of many failures on his part that night. He had paused in the kitchen to pour a glass of water from the tap. He chugged it, set the glass in the sink, wiped his chin dry, and headed to the next room. He slipped on the floor, and this time his big body tumbled. It was slick herringbone pattern parquet, and he had fallen before. Yet this time would be far different because of what he was about to observe. The moonlight had shafted in through the front window enough that he could see clearly. When he held up his hand, it was a different color. Red blood. It had come from somewhere, and he picked himself up to find out where. He discovered the source in the next room. Johnny Sachs, his brother-in-law. A big, burly fellow like him laid low. He bent closer, got on his knees, his face an inch or so from Johnny's. His throat had been slit from ear to ear. There was no need to check for a pulse. There could be none. Most of his blood was on the floor. He should have pulled his phone and hit 911 at that very moment. He knew better. He knew not to stampede around a crime scene, for that was what his home had become by virtue of the dead man, killed by violent means. It was now a museum. You didn't touch anything. His professional side screamed this at him. But this was only one body. His gaze jerked to the stairs and his mind suddenly disengaged as total panic seized every bit of him. The gut feeling that life had just robbed Decker of everything he would ever have. So he ran, his boots pushing, coagulating pools of blood outward like an incoming tide. He was destroying vital evidence, royally screwing up what should have been kept pristine. Right now, he didn't give a damn. He tracked Johnny's blood right up the stairs, taking the treads three at a time. His breaths were gasps, and his heart was pumping so fast and feeling so bloated. It was a wonder his chest wall could contain it. His mind seemed paralyzed, but his limbs were somehow still moving of their own accord. He hit the hallway, bounced off one wall and then its twin as he rocketed down to the first door on the left. He never took out his gun, not even bothering to think that the killer could still be there, waiting for him to come home. He smashed open the door with his shoulder and looked wildly around. Nothing. No, not true. He froze in the doorway as the light on the nightstand dimly illuminated the bare foot that protruded above the mattress on the far side. He knew that foot. He had held it, massaged it, and kissed it on occasion over many years. It was long, narrow, but somehow still dainty. The toe next to the big one slightly longer than it should have been. The veins on the side, the calluses underneath, the nails painted red. It was all as it should be, except it should not be poking above the mattress at this time of night. That meant the rest of her was down on the floor. And why would that be, unless... He edged to that side of the bed and looked down. Cassandra Decker, Cassie to all including, and most importantly him, stared up at him from her position on the floor. Well, staring was beyond her now. He stumbled forward, stopped next to her, and then slowly knelt, his blue jean knees coming to rest in the patch of blood that had collected next to her. Her blood. Her neck was clean, no wound there. That was not the source of the blood. Her forehead was. Single-entry gunshot. He knew he shouldn't, but he used his arm to scoop her head off the floor, cradled it next to his heaving chest. Her long dark hair splayed out over his arm like frozen spray from a hard breaker. The dot on her forehead was blackened and blistered from the heat of the bullet. A contact wound preceded by a muzzle's kiss, lasting only a second before the projectile ended her life. Had she been asleep? Had she awoken? Would she have endured the terror of seeing her killer standing over her? He wondered all this as he held his wife for what would be the last time. He put her back where he had found her. Decker stared down at the face that was white and lifeless, the blackened dot in the middle of her forehead, to be his final memory of her, a grammatical period at the very end of everything. He rose, his legs feeling numb as he staggered out of the room and down the hall to the only other bedroom up here. He did not force this door open. He was in no hurry now. He knew what he was going to find. He just didn't know what the killer's method would have been. First a knife, second a gun. She wasn't in the bedroom, which left the adjoining bath. The overhead light was on in there, burning brightly. The killer had obviously wanted him to see the last one clearly. There she sat on the toilet, held there with the sash from her robe wrapped around the water tank, for otherwise she would have fallen over. He drew close. His feet didn't slip. There was no blood. His little girl had no obvious wounds that he could see. But then he drew closer and saw the ligature marks on her neck, ugly and blotchy like someone had burned her there. Maybe the robe sash had been used. Maybe the guy's hands. Decker didn't know, didn't care. Death by strangulation was not painless. It was excruciating and terrifying. And she would have been staring right up at him while he slowly compressed her life away. Marley would have been 10 in 3 days. A party had been planned, guests invited, presents bought, and a sheet cake with chocolate inside ordered. He had gotten time off to help Cassie, who worked full-time and also did pretty much everything here, because his job was not a 9-to-5 or not even close. They had joked about it. What did he know about real life? Grocery shopping, paying the bills, taking Molly to the doctor? Nothing, as it turned out. Not a damn thing. Clueless. He sat down on the floor in front of his dead child, crossing his long legs like his little girl liked to do, so the bottom of each foot was wedged against the inner thigh of the opposite leg. He was flexible for a big man. The lotus position, he dimly thought. Or something like that. He didn't even know why he was thinking this. He realized he must be in shock. Her eyes were wide and open, staring back at him but not seeing him. Like Mom. She would never see him again. Decker just sat there, rocking back and forth, looking at her but not really seeing her, and his baby girl sure as heaven not seeing her daddy either. This is it. Nothing left. I'm not staying by myself, can't do it. He slipped the compact 9mm from his belt holster and made sure around was chambered by racking the slide. He cupped it in his hands. Nice little piece. It was accurate, with enough stopping power. He'd never shot anyone with it, but he'd wanted to. He stared down at the muzzle with the iron sights. How many rounds fired at the police range? 1,000? 10,000? Well, he couldn't miss tonight. He opened his mouth and swallowed the muzzle, angling it upward so the bullet would hit the brain and make the end quick. His finger came to rest on the trigger guard. He looked up at Molly, suddenly embarrassed. He slipped the gun out and put it against his right temple and closed his eyes so he couldn't see her. Again, his index finger slipped to the trigger guard. Once past it, to the trigger, then the slow, steady pull until the point of no return. He'd never feel anything. His brain dead before it could tell the rest of his body that he'd jacked himself. He just had to pull. Just pull, Amos. You got nothing to lose because you got nothing left. They're gone. They're gone. He held the gun there, wondering what he would say to his family once they were all reunited. I'm sorry. Forgive me. I wish I'd been here to protect you from whoever did this. I should have been here to protect you. He held the gun tighter, digging the metal against his temples so hard he felt the smooth barrel cut into his skin. A drop of blood appeared and then was wicked into his graying hair, which he was fairly certain had become even grayer over the last few minutes. He wasn't seeking the courage to do it. He was desperately searching for the right balance. Yet could there ever be balance in taking one's own life? Still holding the gun in place, he slid out his phone, dialed 911, identified himself by name and badge number, and in two concise sentences described the slaughter of a trio of people. He dropped the phone on the floor. Down below was Johnny. Down the hall was Cassie. Here on the toilet was Molly. And suddenly, without warning, he was seeing all this outlined in the most terrifying shade of blue. The bodies, the house, the whole night. This bubble of blue, it was everywhere. And he tilted his gaze to the ceiling and screamed out a curse, fueling it with all the rage and loss he was right now feeling. The damn colors intruding even on this. Why could he not be normal for just this one time in his complete misery? He lowered his head and sat there on the floor with a gun to his head and absolutely nothing left in the rest of him. He was ready to die, ready to join them. But for some reason, unknown even to him, Amos Decker didn't pull the trigger. And so that was exactly how the cops found him when they showed up 4 minutes later. Chapter 2. A park bench painted red. The unsettling knife-like chill of fall draining to winter. Amos Decker sat on the bench, waiting. A sparrow zipped across in front of him, narrowly dodged a passing car before soaring upward, catching a breeze and drifting away. He noted the make, model, plate number, and physical descriptions of all in the car before it left him. Husband and wife in the front, and a kid in the back in a booster seat. Another one next to him, older, about 10. The rear bumper had a sticker. It read, "My kid is an honor roll student at Thorncrest Elementary." "Congrats. You just told a psycho exactly where to snatch your very smart kid." Then a bus rolled to a near stop. He ran his gaze over it, making the same observations. 14 passengers, most looking depressed and tired, though it was still only midday. One was energetic, a child. He bebopped next to his exhausted mother, who sat slumped over, a fat bag perched in her lap. The driver was a newbie, her face a sheet of nervousness. Even with the power steering, she fought the wheel and took the next turn so slowly it looked like the bus's engine had died. A plane soared overhead low enough for him to ID it as a United 737, a later model because of the winglets. With the number 737, for him the color silver popped out. The number 737 was, in his mind, a beautiful concoction, sleek, silver, fast, bullet-like. Anything beginning with a 7 gave him that reaction. He appreciated that Boeing numbered all its aircraft beginning with 7. Two young men walked past, observed, recorded. One was older, bigger, the alpha. The other was the sidekick, only there for laughs and to push around. Then he noted the four kids playing in the park across the street. Age, rank, serial number, pecking order, and hierarchy established before age six like a pack of wolves. Done. Next, a woman with a dog, a German shepherd. Not that old, but with bad hips. Probably dysplasia, common in the breed. Catalogued. A man jabbering away on his smartphone. Xenia suit. The G for Gucci on the slick shoes. Quarter-sized rock, set in a gold band on his left hand, like a Super Bowl ring. $4,000 Zenith watch on his right wrist. He was too small and the wrong build for a pro athlete. Dressed far too nicely for a typical drug dealer. Maybe a hedge fund manager, malpractice lawyer, or real estate developer. Memory socked away. On the other side of the street, an old woman in a wheelchair was being rolled out of a medical transport van. Her left side was useless, facial paralysis on the same side, stroke, documented. Her caregiver had mild scoliosis with a club foot, imprinted. Amos Decker noted all this, and more, as his mind sorted through everything that was in front of him. Deducing here and there, speculating sometimes, guessing other times. None of it meant anything other than it was just what he did to pass the time while he was waiting. Just like counting in color. Just what he did to pass the time. He had lost the house to foreclosure. They were barely making the payments with his and Cassie's salary. On his paycheck alone, it was a no-go. He had tried to sell it, but who wanted to live in a house covered in blood? He'd lived in an apartment for several months, then a motel room. Then, when his job situation changed, he had relocated to a friend's couch. After the friend became less friendly, he had opted for a homeless shelter. When funding ran out for the place and it was closed, he downsized to a sleeping bag in the park, then a cardboard box in a parking lot when the sleeping bag wore out and the cops rousted the homeless from the park. He had hit rock bottom. Bloated, dirty, wild-haired, bushy-bearded. He looked like he should be living in a cave somewhere, attempting to conspire with aliens. And he pretty much was until he woke up in a Walmart parking lot one morning, staring at a Georgia Pacific logo on the inside of his corrugated box, and at the churning epiphany that Cassie and Molly would have been deeply ashamed of what he had become. So he had cleaned himself up, worked a bunch of odd jobs, saved some dollars, and moved into a room at the Residence Inn and hung out his PI shingle. He took whatever cases came his way. They were mostly low-ball, low-pay, but they were something, and he didn't need more than something. It was a meaningless existence, really, just like he was. Meaningless. His beard was still bushy, his hair still pretty wild, and he was still way overweight. But his clothes were reasonably clean, and he showered sometimes more than twice a week. And he no longer lived in a box. In his mind, progress was always to be measured in inches, especially when you didn't have yards or even feet of success to show off. He closed his eyes to block out his recent street observations, though it was all still there, like a cinema screen on the inside of his eyeballs. It would always still be there. He often wanted to forget what he had just seen, but everything in his head was recorded in permanent marker. He either dialed it up when needed, or it popped up of its own accord. The former was helpful, the latter infinitely frustrating. That night the cops had talked him out of eating a round from his pistol. He had thought many times since of killing himself, so much so that while still on the police force he'd gone to therapy to work around that little issue. He'd even stood in front of a circle of like-minded suicidals. "I am Amos Decker. I want to kill myself. Period. End of story." He opened his eyes. 15 months, 21 days, 12 hours, 14 minutes. Because of what he was, the clock was spinning in the forefront of his mind. That was the span of time that had passed since he had discovered the three bodies in his home, his family wiped out. And in 60 seconds, it would be 15 minutes plus the year, months, and days. and on it would go. He looked down at himself, a four-year college football player and a professional for an extraordinarily short stint. He had kept fit as a cop and later a detective. But he had not bothered with any of that after officially identifying the bodies of his wife, brother-in-law, and daughter. He was 50 pounds overweight, probably more, probably a lot more. 6'5" and a blimp with bum knees. His gut was soft and pushed out, his arms and chest flabby, his legs two meat sticks. He could no longer see even his overly long feet. His hair was also long, peppered liberally with gray and not very clean. It seemed perfectly suited to conceal a mind that, by forgetting nothing, managed to let him down all the time. His beard was startling, both for its bulk and for its chaotic appearance, wisps and curls and stray strands meandering everywhere, like vines searching for purchase on something. But he told himself it was good for his line of work. He had to go chase scum, and scum, by definition, did not often look mainstream. Indeed, they often ran from it. He touched the threadbare patch on his jeans and then looked down at the knees where the blood stains were still visible. Her blood, Cassie's blood. Morbid, to still have it there. Burn the pants, Amos. Most normal people would have done that. But I'm not normal. I haven't been normal since I stepped on that field and took that hit. The hit was the only thing he had never remembered. Ironic, since it was the catalyst for his never forgetting anything else. But it had been played relentlessly on the sports shows at the time. And even the national news felt the need to document the violence done to him to their countrywide audience. Someone told him the snippet had even been uploaded to YouTube a few years ago and had over 8 million views. And yet he had never seen it. He didn't have to. He'd been there. He'd felt it. That was enough. And all he had done to deserve the folderol of attention was to die on a football field, not once, but twice. He ran a furtive, mostly embarrassed glance down at his jeans. His gut hung over the waistband, because he'd been far thinner back then. He had washed them, but the bloodstains had not come out. Why should they be different from his brain? The pants could have, should have been evidence. Let the cops take them, but they hadn't, and he hadn't offered. He kept them, wore them still. Stupid way of remembering. Asinine, really. Horribly macabre way of keeping Cassie with him, like toting her ashes in a Scooby-Doo lunchbox. But then again, he wasn't really okay. Even though he had a place to live, held a job, and was functioning for the most part, he really wasn't okay. He would never be okay in any way. He technically had been a suspect in the case, because husbands always were, but not for long. The timing of the deaths cleared him. He had an alibi. He didn't care about alibis. He knew he hadn't touched one hair on their heads, and didn't give a damn if no one else thought the same. The real issue was that no one had ever been arrested for the murders. There hadn't even been any suspects, not a lead to come by, nothing. The working-class neighborhood they had lived in was quiet and the folks friendly, always offering a helping hand to others because nobody had much and everybody needed some assistance from time to time. Fixing a car or a furnace, or hammering a nail into a board, or cooking a meal because a mom was sick, or shepherding kids in a communal transportation system based on trust and need. There were some tough nuts who lived there, for sure. But he hadn't spotted a homicidal one in the bunch. Mostly bikers and potheads. He had looked. He had done nothing else except investigate the crimes, even though officially they had told him to stay away from it all. But no clues presented themselves, even with his obsessively running everything down. There were opportunities and obstacles for a crime such as this. Doors were left unlocked, folks came and went. So access was clearly there, but the houses were close together, so something should have been heard, but no sounds were ever heard from 4305 Boston Avenue that night. How could three people have died so quietly? Didn't violent death provoke outrage, screams, a struggle, something? Apparently not. The gunshot? Like a ghost whispering. Or else the whole neighborhood had gone deaf that night, and blind, and mute. And months later there was still nothing. Long after the trail had grown cold and the odds of solving the case and catching the killer had dropped to near zero. He had left the police force then because he could no longer push paper and run down other cases and bother with precinct drama. The upper management said they were sorry to see him go, but no one asked him to stay, either. The truth was, he was becoming disruptive, unmanageable. And he was all of those things, because he no longer cared about anything. Well, except for one thing. He had visited their graves all the time. They were buried in plots he had hastily purchased, because who would buy a plot for a man and a woman in their early 40s and a grave for a 10-year-old? But then he had stopped going because he could not face them lying there in the dirt. He had not avenged them. He had done nothing except identify their bodies. A pitiful penance for letting his family die. God would hardly be impressed. Their deaths had to be connected with what he did. He had put lots of people away over the years. Some were out now. Others had friends. Just before the murders at 4305 Boston Avenue, he had helped break up a local meth ring that was doing its best to make everybody in the metro area an addict, and thus a good customer. Young, old, and every demographic in between. These dudes were bad, evil. Kill you to look at you. They could have found out where he lived easy enough. He wasn't undercover. And they might have taken out their revenge on his wife and child, and her brother, who had picked the wrong time to visit from out of town. But there was not a scrap of evidence against this group, and without that, no arrest, no trial, no judgment, no execution. His fault, his guilt, maybe led them right to his family, and now he had no family. The community had held a fundraiser for him. Collected a few thousand bucks. It was all sitting in a bank account untouched. Taking the money would have seemed to him to be an act of betrayal for those he had lost. So the money sat, though he certainly could have used it. He was getting by, barely. But barely was all he needed. Because barely was all he was now. He settled back against the wood of the bench and shrugged his coat closer around him. He was not here by accident. He was here on a job, and as he looked to his left, he saw that it was time to get to work. He rose and headed after the two people he'd been waiting for. Chapter 3 The bar was much like every other bar Decker had ever been in. Dark, cool, musty, smoky, where light fell funny and everyone looked like someone you knew or wanted to know. Or more likely, wanted to forget. Where everyone was your friend until he was your enemy and cracked a pool stick over your skull. Where things were quiet until they weren't. Where you could drink away anything that life threw at you. Where 1,000 Billy Joel wannabes would serenade you into the wee hours. Only I could drink 1,000 drinks and never forget a damn thing. I would just remember every detail of the 1,000 drinks down to the shapes of the ice cubes. Decker took a seat at the bar where he could see himself in the reflection of the big mirror behind the stacked rows of Beam and Beef, Glen and Sapphire. He ordered a dollar draft, clutched the mug between his hammy hands, and studied the mirror. Back corner and to the right. They had sat down there. The couple he'd followed into the place. The gent was late 40-ish. The girl, half that. The man was dressed in the best he had. A pinstripe wool three-piece yellow tie dotted with blue flecks in the shape of what looked to be sperms on the way to fertilize an egg, and a dandy pocket handkerchief to match. Hair swept back revealed a lined, mature brow, attractive on a man, less so on a woman, but then life had always been unfair that way. Impressive diamond rings on the manicured fingers, probably stolen, or fakes, like he was. His toenails were probably clipped, too. His shoes were polished, but he'd missed the backs. They were scuffed, which came much closer to the man's actual nature. He was scuffed, too, and he only wanted to impress on the way in, not on the way out. After the way out, you'd never see the prick again. She was doe-eyed and doe-brained, pretty in a vacuous, seen-it-a-thousand-times sort of way, like watching a 3D movie without the requisite glasses. Something was just off. The lady was so blindly faithful and oblivious that part of you just wanted to walk away and leave her to her fate. But Decker was being paid not to do that. In fact, he was being paid to do the opposite. She was dressed in a skirt and jacket and blouse that probably cost more than Decker's car, or the car he'd once had. The bank had gotten that too, as banks often did. She came from old money. She was so used to the privileged life that was attached to such status that it made her incapable of understanding why someone would work so hard to snatch from her things she simply took for granted. That made her a potential victim every minute of every day of her life. Such was the current moment, the shark and the dummy. Decker saw him as a 6, a dirty number in his mind. She was a 4, innocuous and uninteresting. They touched hands and then lips. They shared drinks. He a whiskey sour, she a pink martini. Figured. Decker nursed his beer and bided his time. He looked at them without seeming to. In addition to the number tag, to him she was outlined in orange, the guy in purple, the same color he associated with 0, an unwelcome digit. So the guy really represented 2 numbers to him, 6 and 0. It seemed complicated, he knew, but he had no difficulty keeping it straight because it was just there in his head, as clear as an image in a mirror. And it wasn't that he saw them exactly in those colors. It was the perception of those colors. That was the best and only way he could explain the sensation. It wasn't like they taught a class on this, and he had come to it relatively late in the game. He was just doing the best he could. After all, he thought he'd left the world of Crayola back in kindergarten. They continued with their lovey-dovey, hand-holding, foot-rubbing, heavy-petting afternoon fun and games. She obviously wanted more. He was unwilling to give it, because you teased a mark. Rushing could only mean bad things, and this guy was good. Not the best Decker had seen, but serviceable. He probably made a decent living. For a purple 0. Decker knew the guy was waiting to make an ask. A loan for a business prospect that couldn't miss. Some tragedy in his extended family that needed financial remedy. He wouldn't want to do it, hated himself for it, but this was his last resort. She was his last chance, and he didn't expect her to understand or say yes. The debate framed that way. What other answer could she give, except,
"Yes, my darling, take double, triple even. Daddy will never miss it. It's only money, after all, his money."
An hour and 2 more pink martinis later, she left him there. Her parting kiss was tender and moving, and he reacted in just the right way, until she turned away, and his expression changed. From one of reciprocal tenderness and love to one of triumph, and some might even say cruelty. At least that's what Decker would say. Decker did not like interacting with people. He preferred his own company. He hated idle conversation because he no longer understood his point. But this was part of what he did. This was how he paid the bills. So he told himself to get over it, at least for now. Because it was time to punch the clock. He carried his beer over to the table in time to put a massive hand on the man's shoulder and push him back into the seat he was just about to vacate. Decker sat across from him, eyed the man's untouched whiskey sour. Predators didn't drink on the job. And then raised his own beer in praise. Nice work. I like to see a real pro on the job. The man said nothing at first. He eyed Decker, sizing up his unkempt appearance and looking unfavorably impressed. Do I know you? He said at last, his tone snarky. Because I don't see how that's possible. Decker sighed. He had expected something a bit original. It was apparently not to be. No. And you don't have to know me. All you have to do is look at these. He pulled the manila envelope from his coat pocket and passed it across. The man hesitated, but then picked it up. Decker took a drink of his beer and said, Open it. Why should I? Fine, then, don't open it. No sweat off here. He went to take the envelope, but the man jerked it out of reach. He undid the binding and slid out the half-dozen photos. First rule of a con, Slick, said Decker. Don't play on the sidelines while you're on a job. And when I said you were a pro, I was being charitable. His hand reached out, and he tapped the photo on top. She doesn't have enough clothes on, and neither do you. And by the way, that particular act is illegal in pretty much all states south of the Mason-Dixon. The man glanced up, his look one of caution. How did you get these? Again, Decker felt disappointed by the query. So now it's just a matter of negotiation. I'm authorized to give you $50,000. In return, you write this one off and move on to someone else in another state. The man smiled, slid the photos back, and said, If you thought these were a real problem for me, why not just show them to her? Why come here and offer me a way out with cash? Decker sighed once more and for the third time felt disappointed. This guy was just not a challenge. He collected the photos and put them back neatly in the envelope. You read my mind, Slick. Exactly what I told your old man. Thanks for validating my opinion. The girl's very religious, by the way. What you're doing to the lady in that third picture is a deal killer, in addition to the fact that she's your wife. Have a good one. He rose to leave, but the man clutched at his arm. I can hurt you, he said. Decker took the man's fingers and bent them back until he gasped, and then and only then did Decker let go. He said, I'm fat, but I'm two of you and a whole lot meaner. I don't have to have a pretty face to do what I do, but you do. So if I take you out back and smash it in, what does that do for your future cash flow? You see my point? The man held his injured hand and paled. I'll take the money. Great. I have the check for $25,000 right here. You said it was $50,000. That was only if you pulled the trigger when I asked. You didn't. The consequences are your return goes down by half. You son of a bitch. Decker sat back down and slipped a piece of paper from his pocket. Plane ticket. One way. For as far away from here as you can get without leaving the lower 48. Leaves in 3 hours. A condition of the check clearing is you being on it. They'll have people there to confirm. So don't do anything stupid. Where's the check? Demanded the man. Decker pulled out another piece of paper. You need to sign this first. He handed the paper across. The man ran his gaze down it. But this ensures the lady will never think of you again except in a very bad way, which means even if you try to slink back here, it'll be a no-go. The man's brain ran through what was happening, what this all really meant. So, you're blackmailing me with the photos and the fact that I'm married to get me to sign this. And if I don't sign it, you'll show her the photos and tell her I'm married and trust that will be enough to get me off her? What a genius you are. The man sneered. I have a dozen more just like her, and far better looking. She wanted me to sleep with her. I kept putting it off. You saw the photos. I have filet mignon at home. Why would I settle for hamburger, even if it does come with a trust fund? She's a dumb shit, and she's only fair-looking on a good day even with all of Daddy's money. Mr. Mark saw you coming from a mile away, even if his little girl didn't. But then again, Jenny's been taken in before by scum like you. She deserves better. Decker didn't know Jenny Marks, and could not have cared less about her romantic entanglements. He had made these comments because he needed Slick to keep going, keep talking, get it all off his chest. She deserves better. Shit, I don't know why I even bothered. I could get better ass than Jenny Marks without even trying, and I wouldn't have to listen to her baby talk. Dumb shit, baby talk, really? Lady has a college degree. Decker already had more than he needed, but he was starting to enjoy this. Actually, she's not a dumb shit. She's a freaking moron. Okay, fun is over. Decker took the unsigned piece of paper and slid it into the envelope with the photos. He put them all away in his coat pocket. What the hell are you doing? The man said incredulously. In answer, Decker pulled out a miniature digital recorder and hit play. I'm sure she'll enjoy your description of her, said Decker. What kind of hamburger, by the way? All beef? Organic? Or just freaking moronic? The man sat there looking stunned. Decker put the recorder away and pushed the one-way ticket toward the guy. We'll let you keep this. Be sure your butt is on the plane. The next guy they send out will be even bigger than me. And it won't just be your fingers, he cracks. It'll be you. The man said pitifully, Are you telling me I get none of the money? Decker stood. Like I said, what a genius you are. Chapter 4 Decker sat on his bed in his one room about the size of a prison cell. For dealing with clients, he used the table in the dining room of the Residence Inn, where his monthly payment included a daily buffet breakfast. They were definitely losing money on him with that arrangement. He would just pick up entire plates of food from the buffet and carry them to his table. He could have used a backhoe instead of a fork. He had gotten his check from Mr. Mark's emissary. A buddy on the police force had recommended Decker to the rich guy to handle this delicate matter concerning his vapid daughter, who was always falling in love with the wrong guy. He'd never met with the old man, only his reps. That was okay. He doubted Marks would have wanted him soiling his fancy furniture. They had met at the breakfast bar, two young jerks in $1,000 suits who declined to even sample the coffee. They were probably more into double espressos spit out from those tiny little machines manned by a barista. He could tell from their expressions that they knew exactly how good they had it and how not good Decker had it. He'd worn his best shirt to the meeting, meaning the other one. Daddy Marks had authorized up to $100,000 to get rid of the albatross around his little girl's neck. After sizing up the con, Decker had told the reps he could get it done for a lot less. And he had. For the price of a one-way ticket, in fact. Chump change. You think Daddy Warbucks would have bonused him at least a percentage of the six-figure savings. But he stuck to the letter of their agreement, and Decker just got his flat hourly rate, though he'd padded that considerably and made a nice payday for himself. Yet a percentage would have been good, probably how the rich stayed rich. But it had been worth it to see a con, and he figured Jenny Marks would be in the same boat in a few more months, and he'd get called up again. Maybe he should ask Daddy Warbucks for a retainer. He left his room and made his way to the dining area right off the inn's lobby. It was early, and he was the only one there other than the 80-year-old June, who was enjoying her golden years by shoveling greasy home fries onto a platter at the buffet stand. After loading up his plate, he sat down to eat at his usual table. His first forkful was halfway to his mouth when he saw her come in. She would be 42 now, same age as he was. She looked older. Her job just did that to a person. It had done so to him. He lowered his gaze and his fork and salted everything on his plate four times over, including the pancakes. He was hoping that a man of his considerable size could shrink to invisibility behind a wall of protein and carbs.
Hello, Amos.
Well, apparently not. He shoved a forkful of congealed eggs, grits, bacon, home fries, and ketchup down his throat. He chewed with his mouth open, hoping that the sight would prompt her to hit a U-turn and go back to where she came from. No such luck. She sat down across from him. The table was small, and she was small as well. But he was not. He was huge. He took up most of the table just by being there.
How are you doing?
He stuffed more food into his mouth and smacked his lips together. He didn't look up. What would have been the point? There was nothing that she could possibly say that he would want to hear.
I can wait this out. If that's how you want to play it, I've got all the time in the world.
He finally looked at her. She was stick-thin because of the cigarettes and the gum, which she always substituted for food and drink. He was probably having more food at this one meal than she put away in a month. Her hair was a pasty blonde, her skin wrinkled and splotchy. Her nose was crooked. Some said from an encounter with a mean drunk when she was a B cup. Her small, pointy chin seemed overwhelmed by her disproportionately large mouth, where uneven and nicotine-stained teeth lurked like bats hanging in a cave. She was not pretty. Her looks were not what made her memorable. What made her remarkable was that she had been the first female detective in the Burlington Police Department. As far as he knew, she was still the only one. And she had been his partner. They had made more arrests, leading to more convictions than anyone in the history of the department. Some on the force thought that was just great. Others thought they were full of themselves. Starsky and Hutch, one rival had called them. Decker never knew which one he was supposed to be, the blonde or the brunette. "Hello, Mary Suzanne Lancaster," he said, because he somehow couldn't not say it. She smiled, reached over, and poked his shoulder. He winced slightly and drew back a bit, but she didn't seem to notice.
"I didn't know you even knew my middle name."
He looked down at his food, his limited chit-chat quota exhausted. She ran her gaze over him, and when she was done, Lancaster seemed to silently acknowledge that all reports of Decker having hit rock bottom were spot on.
"I won't ask how you've been, Amos. I can see not too good."
"I live here instead of in a box," he said bluntly. Startled, she said,
"I'm sorry, I didn't mean it that way."
"You need something?" he asked. "I have a schedule." She nodded.
"I'm sure. Well, I came by to talk to you."
"Who did you talk to?"
"You mean, how did I know you were here?"
His look told her that was obviously his question.
"Friend of a friend."
"Didn't think you had that many friends," said Decker. It wasn't a funny line, really, and he certainly didn't smile, but she forced a chuckle as a potential icebreaker, but then caught herself, realizing probably that it was stupid to do so.
"Well, I'm also a detective. I can find out things, and Burlington isn't that big. It's not New York or L.A.
He smacked his lips, shoveled in some more food, and his mind started to wander back to colored numbers and things that could tell time in his head. She seemed to sense his withdrawal.
"I'm sorry for everything that's happened to you. You lost a lot, Amos. You didn't deserve this. Not that anyone does."
He glanced at her with not a single emotion evident in the look. Sympathy was not going to hold his attention. He had never sought sympathy, mainly because his mind really didn't get that particular sensation, at least not anymore. He could be caring. He had been caring and loving with his family. But sympathy, and its even more irritating cousin, empathy, were no longer in his wheelhouse. Perhaps sensing that she was losing him again, she quickly said,
"I also came to tell you something."
He ran his gaze up and down her. He couldn't help himself, so he said, "You've lost weight, about 5 pounds you couldn't afford to lose, and you might have a vitamin D deficiency."
"How do you figure?"
"You were walking stiffly when you came in. Bone ache is a classic symptom." He pointed to her forehead. "And it's cold outside, but your head is sweating, another classic. And you've crossed and uncrossed your legs 5 times in the brief time you've been sitting there, bladder problems, another symptom. She frowned at this very personal appraisal.
What, did you start medical school or something?
I read an article 4 years ago while I was waiting at the dentist's office. She touched her forehead.
I guess I don't get out in the sun much.
And you smoke like a rocket, which doesn't help anything. Try a supplement. Vit-D deficiencies lead to bad stuff. And quit the cigarettes. Try a patch. He glanced down and saw what he had seen when she first sat down. He said, "You also have a tremor in your left hand." She held it with her right, unconsciously rubbing at the spot.
"I think it's just a nerve thing."
"But you shoot left-handed, so you might want to check it out." She glanced down at the slight bulge on the right side of her jacket, at the waistband where her pistol rode in a belt holster. She smiled.
"You have any more Sherlock Holmes stuff to throw at me? Want to check out my knees? Look at my fingertips? Tell me what I had for breakfast?"
He took a prolonged sip of coffee. "Just have it checked out. Could be something else. More than a tremor. Bad stuff starts in the hands and the eyes. It's an early warning, like a canary in a coal mine. And departmental firearms research comes up next month. Doubt you'll pass with your gripped hand going wacky on you." Her smile faded.
"I hadn't thought about that. I will. Thanks, Amos."
He looked down at his food and drew a deep breath. He was done, just waiting for her to leave. He closed his eyes. He might just go to sleep right here. She idly played with the button of her jacket, shooting glances at him, preparing for what she had really come here to do, to say.
"We made an arrest, Amos. In your case."
Amos Decker opened his eyes and kept them open. Chapter 5. Decker placed his hands on the table. Lancaster noted the hands turning to fists and the thumb rubbing against the forefinger so hard it was leaving a mark. "His name?" asked Decker, staring at a mound of uneaten scrambled eggs.
"Sebastian Leopold. Unusual one, but that's what he said."
Decker once more closed his eyes and turned on what he liked to call his DVR. This was one of the positives of being what he was. The frames flew past his eyes so fast it was hard to see, but he could still see everything in there. He came out the other end of this mental exercise with not a single hit. He opened his eyes and shook his head. "Never heard of him. You?"
"No. And again, that's just what he told us. It might not be his real name."
"No ID, then?"
"Nope, nothing. Empty pockets. I believe he's homeless."
"Run his prints?"
"As we speak. No hits yet."
"How'd you get onto him?"
"That was the easy part. He walked into the precinct at 2 o'clock this morning and turned himself in. Easiest collar we've ever made. I've just come from interviewing him."
Decker shot her a penetrating look. After nearly 16 months, the guy walks in and cops to a triple homicide?
"I know. Certainly doesn't happen every day."
"Motive?" She looked uncomfortable.
"I just came here to give you a courtesy heads up, Amos. It's an ongoing police investigation. You know the drill."
He leaned forward, nearly clearing the width of the table, in a level voice as though he was staring at her across the distance of their slung-together desks back at the police station, he said, "Motive?" She sighed, pulled a stick of gum from her pocket, bent it in half, and popped it into her mouth. 3 quick chews, and she said,
"Leopold said you dissed him once. Pissed him off."
"Where and when?"
"At the 7-Eleven, about a month before. Well, before he did what he did. Man apparently holds a grudge. Between you and me, I don't think the guy is all there."
"Which 7-Eleven?"
"What?"
"Which 7-Eleven?
The one near your house, I believe."
"On DeSalle? At 14th, then?"
"He said he followed you home. That's how he knew where you lived."
"So he's homeless, but has a car. Because I never walked to that 7-Eleven in my life."
"He's homeless now. I don't know what his status was back then. He just walked into the precinct, Amos. There's a lot we still don't know."
"Mugshot." It wasn't a question. If he had been arrested, they had to take his picture and his prints. She held up her phone and showed it to him. On the small screen was the face of a man. It was sunburned and grimy. His hair was wild, and he was crazy bearded. And, well, in that way, Leopold looked like Decker. He closed his eyes, and his internal DVR turned back on. But at the other end, there were, again, no hits. I've never seen him.
Well, he might look different now.
He shook his head and said, "How old?"
Hard to say, and he didn't. Maybe early 40s, maybe.
How big is he?
6 feet, and about 170.
Lean or flabby?
Lean. Pretty wiry, from what I could tell.
My brother-in-law was my size, construction worker, and he could bench press a truck. How'd Leopold manage it in a hand-to-hand confrontation?
That's part of the investigation, Amos. I can't say.
He looked directly at her again, but this time let his silence speak for him. She sighed, chewed her gum ferociously, and said,
"He told us your brother-in-law was drunk at the kitchen table. Never saw it coming. He said he thought he was you, in fact. At least, from behind."
He thought it was killing me when he was slitting my brother-in-law's throat? I don't look anything like my brother-in-law.
From the back, Amos, and I'm telling you, this Leopold is a whack job. His elevator doesn't leave the basement.
Decker closed his eyes. So then this whack job with the broken elevator for a brain next went upstairs and shot my wife and strangled my daughter? He opened his eyes when Lancaster rose from her seat. "I have more questions," he said.
"Well, I have no more answers. I could lose my badge for coming here and telling you what I just did. You know that, Amos."
He rose too, towering over her, a great big blob of a man who could cause little children to run screaming away in fear just by being. "I need to get in to see this guy."
"Impossible."
Lancaster was already backing away. Then she noticed the bulge at his waistband.
"Are you carrying?"
she said incredulously. He didn't glance to where she was staring. "I turned in my weapon when I left the force."
"Not what I asked. Anybody can buy a gun. One more time. Are you carrying?"
"If I were, there's no law against it here."
"Open carry. But there is a law against carrying one concealed, unless you're a police officer."
"It's not concealed. You can see it, can't you? From where you're standing?"
"That's not the same thing, Amos, and you know it."
He held out his hands, one next to the other, then cuffed me. "Take me in and put me in the same holding cell as Sebastian Leopold. You can take my gun, I won't need it." She backed away some more.
"Just don't push this. Let us do our job. We've got the guy. Let it run fair and square. We have the death penalty here. He could get the needle for what he did."
"Yeah, 10 years from now, maybe. And so for a decade he gets a home with a bed and 3 squares. And if he is crazy and his lawyer papers it just the right way, he goes away for life to a nice comfy psych ward to read books, work puzzles, go to counseling, and get free meds that make him feel no pain. From where he's looking, not bad. I'd take that deal right now, in fact."
"He confessed to 3 murders, Amos."
"Let me see him." She had already turned away and was fast walking back to probably where she had parked her car. She turned back around once and snarled,
"By the way, you're welcome, you prick."
He watched until she was gone from the lobby. He sat back down at his table. He considered it his because everyone needed some place to call his own, and this spot was it for him. He had woken up this morning with not a single purpose in life, other than to live until the next morning. Now, that had all changed. Chapter 6 Decker went back to his room and pulled out his phone. He didn't like having to pay for a phone that had internet access, but it was like having a huge library and an army of research assistants on the cheap. He checked the news feeds. They must have a lockdown on the Leopold arrest, because he found nothing. When he searched the name online, he got a few hits, but obviously it was other people only with the same name. The guy had walked in and copped the 3 homicides. Even if he did plead insanity, He was looking at a lifetime inside. Was he the real deal? Had he done it? The cops should be able to tell pretty easily. Decker knew they had held back many details from the public about the crimes. They would interrogate Leopold, if that was his real name, and quickly determine if he was the guy or lying for some reason. If he was the guy, what would Decker do? Try to thwart the criminal justice system and kill him? And end up in prison himself? But if he wasn't the guy, well, that offered up possibilities, too. Right now, he could do nothing. Nothing constructive, at least. Leopold would be arraigned and formally charged, or let go, depending on the outcome of the interrogation. If he were kept locked up, there would be a trial. Or maybe not if the guy pled, which most defendants did. Either because they were poor and had no money for a decent attorney, or they were guilty, or they were both. Rich guys always fought it out, especially with jail time in the equation. They had a lot to lose. But the prosecution wouldn't have to offer a plea. They might want to try this sucker for their own professional gain. If so, Decker would be in the courtroom every day, every minute. He wanted to see this guy, smell this guy, size him up. He lay back on the bed. He looked like he was sleeping, but he was far from it. He was remembering. He was thinking back to what he once was and what he was now. He thought about this often, even when he didn't want to. Sometimes, most of the time, the decision wasn't up to him. It was up to his brain, which, ironically enough, seemed to have a mind of its own. I am Amos Decker. I'm 42 years old and look at least 10 years older on a good day, of which I haven't had one in 479 days, and feel at least a century older than that. I used to be a cop and then a detective, but I'm no longer gainfully employed in either occupation. I have hyperthymesia, which means I never forget anything. I'm not talking about memory techniques where you can teach yourself to remember things better, like the order of a pack of cards using association tricks. No, with me it's just a turbocharged brain that has somehow unlocked what we all have, but never use. There aren't many hyper-Ts, my shorthand, in the world, but I'm officially one of them. And it seems my sensory pathways have also crossed streams so that I count in colors and see time as pictures in my head. In fact, colors intrude on my thoughts at the most random times. We're called synesthetes. So I count in color, and I see time, and sometimes I also associate color with people or objects. Many people with synesthesia are also autistic or have Asperger's syndrome. Not me. But I no longer like to be touched, and jokes don't really register with me anymore. But that may be because I don't ever intend to laugh again. I was once normal, or as close as humans get to that state. And now, I'm not. His phone buzzed. He looked at the screen. He didn't recognize the number, but that meant nothing. In drumming up PI work, he had left his phone number a lot of places. He didn't want to focus on work right now, but then again, he couldn't ignore paying clients either. If he got kicked out of this dump for non-payment, it was back to cardboard, and winter was coming. And while he had a lot of fat on him to keep warm, he would always take a firm roof over paper products. Decker, he answered.
Mr. Decker, I'm Alexandra Jameson with the News Leader. Can I ask you some questions about the recent development in the case involving your family?
How'd you get this number?
Friend of a friend.
Second time I've heard that phrase today. Don't like it any better this go-round.
Mr. Decker, it's been 16 months. You must be feeling something, knowing that the police have finally made an arrest.
How do you know they have?
I work the police beat. I have contacts, solid ones, that told me a suspect is in custody. Do you know any more than that? If you do...
Decker hit the end button, and her voice was cut off. The phone immediately rang again. And he turned it off completely. He hadn't liked the press when he was a detective, though they could be useful in small measures. However, as a PI, he had no use for them at all. And they would get no story or help from him about the case involving his family. He left his room and caught a bus at the corner and rode it to a second bus, which he took all the way downtown. There were a few skyscrapers, mixed in with a bunch of other buildings of low and medium height, some in good shape, others not.
The streets were well laid out on a tight grid of right angles and straight thoroughfares.
He hadn't spent much time downtown. Crime, the serious crime at least, was either on the north side of town or in the suburbs. But the precinct where he had worked, and where the holding cell was for arrestees, was right here, smack in the center. He stood on the street and stared across at a building he had walked into every day for a very long time, Precinct Number 2. It was actually Precinct Number 1 because the old Number 1 had burned down. But no one had taken the time to redo the numbers, probably not in the budget. It was named after Walter James O'Malley, a chief of distinction some 40 years ago. He dropped dead outside a bar with his mistress clinging to his arm.
But that had not stopped them from naming a building after him, which proved conclusively that adultery did not really harm one's legacy, even if it killed you.
His old digs were on the third floor. He could see the one window he would stare out when he wasn't looking at Lancaster, who sat directly opposite